Garrick Olson had his first big Chopin experience at age 9, hearing Artur Rubinstein, one of the great star pianists of an earlier era, in a packed-to-the-rafters all-Chopin concert in the 50s.
I remember particularly the G minor ballade, and I thought it was the most exciting, hair-raising thing. Talk about an experience that changes your life. But it really is something a memory I turn to incredibly frequently.
By now, decades later, Olson is a bit of a Chopin master himself, and he's still fascinated with what Chopin did for music and how he did it.
Piano music after Chopin was a different place. Actually, the whole world of music became gradually a different place. Chopin really did change the pianistic landscape. His music seems to fall from heaven. It seems to be created on the spot. It has this feeling of absolute spontaneity, which comes from being an improviser. Of course, they were all improvisers in those days.
But it isn't as if these improvisations just leapt out of Chopin's mind, messily, onto the page. There are certain interesting paradoxes at work.
And that's one of the great things that makes Chopin who he is that he's at the cusp of violent emotion, always perfectly controlled. You know, he was a very well-dressed guy. He cared very much that his coats and everything and his gloves were absolutely perfectly turned out. And I think he really would work on a piece like this for a very, very long time to make it sound as if it were invented on the spot. George Sand said that he would improvise a piece that would just be enchanting and then spend the next 6 to 8 weeks suffering the tortures of the damned to get it down on paper so that it sounded just like it did when he made it up.
But Olson likes to open the hood of a Chopin piece and look inside at the mechanics of the melodies and bass lines, all with the understanding that in Chopin's lifetime, the piano was just starting to develop as a modern instrument.
And he began to unlock its potential. For example, let me just take several steps backwards. In the old days, when you had a melody, you often put a harmony underneath it. You almost always did. Which gives a nice...
Next, Olson mixes generations. He puts a Mozart-style bass line under a Chopin melody.
If we take the great D-flat Nocturne Opus 27, number 2, and we put an Alberti bass under it, it might sound something like this. It'll sound very ordinary. By the time you get to Chopin, he's expanding things terrifically. And he puts it all under one pedal. It's written right in the score. And in doing so, he provides a magical framework because all of the resonances of all the notes underneath begin to gather into this harmonic glow. So you begin to see and hear how the timbre is so important. The music grows out of the piano and into the piano. It's written for the piano only. The timbre itself becomes an element of the music. If you remember my silly example, that would be okay, but it wouldn't make people's eyes roll back in their heads the way they do when you hear a good performance of this piece. There wouldn't be this absolute ecstasy of sound and melody and timbre and all kinds of things at work. No piano music before Chopin had ever been quite so glamorous. I mean, just think of that nocturne I was just citing. I mean, where you just, oh! or even the most famous of all the nocturnes, which is so beautiful, one forgets how beautiful it is. you know, a piece that's become virtually hackneyed and over-orchestrated, but it's of such a compelling beauty and I use the word glamour in the very best sense.
So the question for this pianist, who has spent his life playing and understanding Chopin, is how hard is it to play? Is it all sweat and agony?
With Chopin, it's not so much the sweat and the agony, although there's plenty of it. But his difficulty is of a kind of organic athleticism. You know, the kind you see perhaps in ice skating or in great athletic endeavors, where the accomplishment is incredibly hard, but once you accomplish it, it's not usually so much of a strain. If you're doing a triple lutz, you do a triple lutz, and the ice skater leaps up and says, you know, and you therefore ignore the hundreds of hours that it took them to get to that place.
He was such a one-man hit factory.
Oh, gosh, wasn't he? And that combined with his incredible melodic gifts, he is a one-man hit parade. He's a one-man top of the charts guy. And that's another astounding thing about Chopin is his popularity, which has been present since the day he was alive. You'll play something like this. Say, oh, I love Chopin. People that have this heartfelt, instant response. So he's, you know, he appeals right across the board. And yet the artists in his time who admired him were the greatest artists of the day. Liszt, Mendelssohn, Schumann. These were the finest and the best, and they were all driven nuts by this guy.
And with that, Garrick Ohlsson glides into Chopin's revolutionary etude, soaring over the ice for a clean landing and a perfect skate.
Great.
For WNYC, I'm Sarah Fischko.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.